Hi, everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of the Dissidents and Dictators podcast. Alongside my unbeatable co-host, Alicia Maldonado. Say hi, Alicia.
Yes, mate. Hello.
We have a terrific episode for you today. We're joined in studio by Alex Gladstein, the Human Rights Foundation's very own Chief Strategy Officer. You may know Alex from his years of work helping lead HRF, or from his pioneering work focusing on how to bring the world of Bitcoin to the fight against dictatorship. We are thrilled to have Alex join us today and can't wait to dive in.
Thanks for having me.
Alex, can you tell us a little bit about yourself before we get into the really gritty, meaty Bitcoin info?
Sure. Grew up in Connecticut, outside of New York City here. Went to high school during the 9/11 Iraq War era. That got me very interested in thinking about the world, and ended up studying Arabic in college and asking a lot of questions. And somehow that led me to an internship here in this building in 2007. So, you know, 17 years ago.
A little bit of time
ago. Moons ago.
And took the train in every day from Connecticut. I was not living on my own at that point. And that was a lot of fun. I was working out of a closet here, burning CDs that looked like they were Britney Spears CDs, but actually were contraband digital content of forbidden films and books that would go into Cuba.
Wait, let's pause there. Yeah. This was with the Human Rights Foundation.
You were burning. That was my first job.
That was your first job
at HRF.
And this is when back in this is late 2000s.
June 2007.
And you're burning CDs to do what? To ship where?
Well, I couldn't go to Cuba at the time, but as people probably know, HRF is a very international organization, and especially at the beginning, most of the team was Latin American, so they could travel to Cuba. So I would build like a backpack for them to take in, which was designed to look like a tourist backpack.
Yeah.
So there was, at that time, CDs were still a thing. And, you know, they would have a thing of CDs and it would be like different music, Pearl Jam or Britney Spears or whatever. But we would like etch on the little semi-transparent circle in the middle of the CD what was actually on it. And then those would disseminate. So that could be like, for example, Animal Farm or some Woody Allen movie
That's
about
so cool.
Soviet Union or Braveheart or V for Vendetta or whatever. Different Hollywood type films with or books on audio with, you know, resistance themes. V for Vendetta was particularly good.
Well, it's a great movie.
Because, you know, obviously it's mostly, it seems like it's about the Bush administration, but it's obviously about tyranny. So that one was good, and there were a ton of other ones. So we would smuggle those in, and Cubans didn't have internet yet, so they would meet in small, quiet groups and watch these and have discussion groups after, which we would facilitate different questions, things like that. This was like 2007, 8, and very powerful. There's a great film about this on Netflix, I think, called Chuck Norris Killed Communism.
I'm already sold.
It's
Chuck
awesome.
Norris has done a lot.
It's really good. No, it's about Romania and how Hollywood films basically brought down the dictator of Romania.
Yes, I will check that out.
And it's an awesome plot because there was one woman who would dub all of these things in Romanian. One woman. So all of these Romanians grew up with this vision of this woman and what she looked like, and she was like a god to them. So the film actually tracks down the woman, and it's amazing.
That's so cool.
That is great. Absolutely wonderful.
I'll be watching that
so
immediately.
It shows the power of soft culture. So Thor, our founder at HRF, was very cognizant of that. So from the very beginning, a lot of our programs relate to culture and technology, and that really inspired me. And I got a chance to also work quite a bit on our North Korea program right from the beginning. We learned that people who escaped to North Korea, who decided to become professionals in the area of human rights, who would live in South Korea when they made it to freedom, were very underfunded. They had nobody to support them. This sort of continues to this day. So HRF stepped in, and we've become, without question, the second largest financial supporter of North Korean-led human rights groups after the State Department.
Wow.
And much more than that. You know, the money's one thing, but the visibility, the attention, the help, you know, the story of some of the collaborations we've had are pretty amazing. I mean, we helped Kang Chul-hwan, who wrote Aquariums of Pyongyang. He's like the Solzhenitsyn in North Korea. He actually met Jimmy Wales at, I think, I don't know, the second Oslo Freedom Forum or something like
Jimmy Wales of Wikipedia.
Yeah, the Wikipedia creator. And they actually jammed on this idea of sending in offline versions of Wikipedia called Kiwix, I think they were called. And they did it. So that's like a cool thing that came out of one of the discussions that happened.
And I think if a lot of folks are familiar with our North Korean work, it might be from the Flash Drives for Freedom.
Well, yeah, this was before Flash Drives for Freedom, which became an official program. But at the beginning, we just sort of had this North Korea desk, and we would do different activities to help. And one of them was to loosely try and support efforts to get information into North Korea. We didn't really believe that a military or diplomatic solution would work, and that it would have to be peer-to-peer information and technology-driven and grassroots, and that's what we did. So this was way, way back. And I mean, some of the other stories were crazy. I mean, we would bring, you know, during that, let's say, decade when I was working most closely on that project, let's say 2008 to 2018, we would go periodically to South Korea with a group of people. We would bring technologists, investors, philanthropists, journalists. We brought the BBC, we brought Vice News, we made movies, we made films. It was a lot of fun. In 2014, the DPRK hacked Sony Pictures. This was pretty well known. It was like the biggest story in the world a few weeks. And we launched a campaign called Hack Them Back. And the Kim regime was really upset about this movie, The Interview.
Right.
Because they dared, the thing they were upset about is that they dared to interview the dictator. This is inconceivable for a North Korean, that their god could be interviewed by like a human subject, right? So they got really upset about that. They hacked Sony Pictures. We said, we're going to hack you back. And we raised money to send in tons of copies of The Interview into North Korea.
I love it so much.
And what was incredible is that, you know, we went with The Hollywood Reporter to like, and Vice and all these media outlets. And we filmed like launching a balloon at the DMZ, packed with copies of The Interview, and we watched it just coast over the DMZ, and I was tracking it with a GPS, because you don't know where the heck it's going to go. And I have still this image on my phone of like the beeps. It was something I bought at like REI and put hand warmers on it, and it's attached to this balloon, and the thing goes into North Korea, and you're watching it. You can actually see this one in particular when it kind of like went in a little bit to North Korea. And then it started to go out, and it went 400 miles to Vladivostok. So you can sort it to that area. So these things work. It was pretty amazing to watch.
So the reason so many North Koreans and even those in Russia as well know of James Franco and Seth Rogen is because of our work and our balloons launching this northward.
Yeah, and to that effect, like Schwarzenegger's super famous, and for any North Korean knows Schwarzenegger and DiCaprio. Like you ask any North Korean defector, and they know them, because Hollywood films have had such a huge impact in North Korea. We also helped build people up. Like, you know, we would go there and we would have friends bring in different defectors to talk to us. And every single one of them had the craziest story you've ever heard. I remember meeting this one guy. His job was to, in the early 90s, was to shoot down South Korean balloon efforts. Like, so before the Sunshine policy or whatever, the concessions that the Kim Dae-young gave to the dictatorship in North Korea, which basically he bought a Nobel Peace Prize. It was pathetic. Ugh. But the before that period of time, the South Korean government ran its own balloon operation. Yeah. They borrowed this from the Germans. The Germans used to do this. The Germans would send balloons to each other.
Yep.
The Democratic and the Communist, blah, blah, blah. So they would do the same thing in the Koreas. They still do. You'll be walking around Seoul and you can find leaflets from the North Korean government. It's kind of crazy. But he said his job was to shoot these things down. And they were filled with like, you know, because it's not like people really care about intellectual stuff.
Right.
So it's like sports, porn, all kinds of stuff like that they're sending in there. And just to give people like an idea of what the outside world is like. And his job was to like shoot them down. That was crazy. But Ji Sung Ho was really the craziest story we'd ever heard. And this is documented, you know, extensively now. But we ran a campaign for him called 6,000 Miles to Freedom. And just a story of this young guy who got in a horrific accident during the famine at the end of the 90s and lost like half his body, basically. He was cut off by a train, and he survived somehow and, you know, dragged himself 6,000 miles, 10,000 kilometers to freedom through mountains and jungles and a country he didn't speak the language in, and finally gets to freedom. And then we meet him like maybe a couple years after that, you know, his English was non-existent at the time, and he hadn't really told his story. And I just remember Thor and I were sitting there, and we were like, oh, my God, this guy's got to go on the Oslo Freedom Forum stage. And we worked really hard on the talk, and he still has the crutches his father carved for him.
That's right.
Yeah. His father was killed, and there's a whole bunch of stuff. You can look up the talk online, but...
It's a powerful talk.
Well, he was at the State of the Union address a few years ago in Washington.
Yeah, that was because of us. Yeah, I mean, he gave the most powerful Oslo talk. It got a huge standing ovation. Former President of Ukraine, Yushchenko, was in the front row. He was like bawling. It was awesome. And we then started helping him get his word out. We connected him to a lot of people, and eventually he worked his way up to being a featured guest at the State of the Union in the United States. It was incredible. And then that helped him become a senator in South Korea. So he's the second ever, I believe.
That's right. Yeah.
Second ever senator who's a North Korean refugee in South Korea. He's currently there now. We just visited him in his office, and it was amazing. What a triumph. So that's the kind of impact our work had over those years. Yeah. And the North Korea thing also gave me a taste of how technology was going to do something that policy wasn't, right? Mm-hmm. No amount of war or sanctions or policy nonsense was going to solve this issue. It's going to be like grassroots people working with each other, in this case, black markets in North Korea. So that was very inspiring. And I mean, from very early on, I was sort of alerted to some of the Bitcoin stuff. Mm-hmm. Julian Assange spoke at the second Oslo Freedom Forum. And a year later, WikiLeaks, you know, pasted a Bitcoin address. And we were all like, that's interesting. And I loosely was following it at the time, but back then it was like some crazy magic internet.
This was what, early 2010?
This was 2011.
2011, yeah.
Well, he spoke in 2010, and then...
And then they posted the
Bitcoin. And then, you know, his team paid for their tickets to the next year's Oslo Freedom Forum in Bitcoin. Well, they had to sell their Bitcoin. Well, and I just remember thinking about it.
Wild.
They probably sold,
a blast from the past.
The amount of Bitcoin that could probably buy the Empire State Building.
It's one of the questions I had for you, though, which is, for the layman of us, a.k.a. me, could you give us a very basic kind of description of what Bitcoin is and how it works, but also to what you're doing with, you know, how it's important, why it's important for financial freedom?
Well, actually, the WikiLeaks thing's perfect. I mean, Bitcoin is money that governments can't stop, very simply. The idea is that all currency online requires trust. And Satoshi Nakamoto, the pseudonymous creator of Bitcoin, we don't know who created Bitcoin. He, she, they, we have no idea. It's one of the most beautiful things about it. Mm-hmm. And what they did is they created a way for us to transact on the internet without trust. I can just send you money and it works. Mm-hmm. There's no need for you to prove to me who you are. It's not a credit system. There's no KYC needed, meaning there's no need for you to fill out a form or paperwork. Mm-hmm. You just produce a string of numbers and I send you some money. And no one can stop it. And it is powered by a very strong incentive system based on human self-interest, which is why it's going to win. It's not based on altruism or doing the right thing. Mm-hmm. It's based on people fighting for themselves and wanting a better money. And ultimately, the reason why it's powerful is it's scarce. There will only ever be 21 million Bitcoin. And that is basically a line of code, but it's controlled by people who run the software all around the world. And no one in their right mind would ever say, yeah, cool, let's change it to 42 million. No one's going to debase themselves. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So you take a very different approach to the principal agent problem, which has totally ruined fiat currency, meaning like government-issued currency, which is that the people who earn and use the money don't control it. Therefore, there's corruption and rent-seeking. In Bitcoin, we delete that entirely. There is no third party in the middle. It's just you, and you control your money. And that's very powerful.
That's a beautiful thing.
So that's how it works. And because it's driven by self-interest, there's no censorship possible. Because let's say the U.S. government or the Chinese government or the Russian government says, hey, this Bitcoin address, we're going to sanction it. And you shouldn't accept this Bitcoin. And you know what? We're going to tell the miners based in the United States to not process transactions coming from that address. Well, guess what? There's people in Oman or Saudi Arabia or Zimbabwe or Argentina or Estonia or wherever, Georgia. They're going to process it. It works because the world is rivalrous and isn't unified. Mm-hmm. And it is very effective at that. There's no way one government can censor. And that's why last night I was thrilled to, I'm going to go to Madeira to speak at a Bitcoin conference next week. And I was talking with a guy who's going to take me surfing. And at the end of the WhatsApp conversation, I was like, can I pay you in Bitcoin? And he was like, hell yeah. And I just paid him right there, right then. I don't know the guy. I don't know anything. I don't know anything about the currency they use in this island. I don't care. Oh. He's on the other side of the world. And I pay him final settlement in minutes. And it's done deal. And my trip is booked. And it's like incredible. So I mean,
even
how
surf
else would
instructors.
You do that?
Even surf instructors are using Bitcoin.
Yeah, the surf instructors on this island, this guy at least, accepts Bitcoin. He's thrilled to.
Wow.
It's easier for him. You know, he doesn't have to deal with a bank wire.
Yep.
Which is an antiquated dinosaur technology.
Bureaucratic regime.
So the point is, this is an evolution of money to allow people to transact directly with each other without the fear of censorship or control or inflation. And I think that that's going to be very desirable. The only way to kill Bitcoin, and we'll finish the little 101 with this, would be that if governments promised to never censor, confiscate, or inflate. And if they promised that, and if they executed on their promise, we would not need Bitcoin.
But they can't
keep
their promises.
Bitcoin would die because people would stop feeding it electricity because it wouldn't be worth anything. But guess what? They're not going to do that. In fact, governments around the world are going to continue to censor, confiscate, and inflate until these currencies become completely worthless.
Right.
And you see this time and time again around the world. And it's tragic because what that means is people's living standards and purchasing power and wages go to zero. And they don't ever get a right to make any determination there. There's never like a referendum on, do you want a currency devaluation? No one's ever in their right mind going to say,
sign
yeah,
me up.
Sure. And it was so I just visited Malawi a few weeks ago. This is a country that just had a 44% currency devaluation imposed by the IMF, maybe 3 months ago. And you're walking around and this is like bottom five poorest country in the world. And people make very, very little. They make like $300 a year.
Wow.
And they all save in cash because they don't have access to US dollars or any foreign market. And it's like, these are not the people who need a 44% reduction in what they can purchase.
Mm-hmm.
It's insane that this happens around the world.
Yeah.
And Bitcoin is an escape. It says basically, no, you can't do that anymore. So it's very, very exciting from a freedom perspective. And the way it really ties into our work is very simple. Dictators need three things. Dictators need confiscation, censorship, and closed capital markets. So Putin and Xi Jinping absolutely need these three things.
Mm-hmm.
They cannot, their regimes would fall tomorrow if they didn't have closed capital markets, censorship, mm-hmm. and confiscation. Bitcoin is the opposite. Bitcoin is free speech, property rights, and open capital markets. So it will eventually destroy dictators, which is really exciting. And the best part is that it'll reinforce and improve democracies. Because at the end of the day, democratic countries like the United States do a lot of bad things, but the good part of what they do is rooted in free speech, property rights, mm-hmm. and open capital markets.
Mm-hmm.
This is why we're successful. And Bitcoin aligns with that. So what's cool is I think that not only will Bitcoin help really cause big problems for totalitarians, but it'll help improve democracies and help us shed some of our worst impulses and actions,
mm-hmm.
which are caused in many ways by a corrupt monetary system where there's zero democratic accountability on the money side of things.
Right.
So governments can stop all other kinds of money. They can inflate it. They can debase it. They can print it out of existence. They can demonetize it, meaning they can say these notes are no longer valid. Can't do this to Bitcoin. So at the time, Assange had pissed a lot of people off. So the US government said, screw you, we're going to shut down all of your banking.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they forced Visa and PayPal or whatever to shut off all of the ways for people to donate to WikiLeaks
mm-hmm.
at the time because he was exposing the U.S. government's crimes in Iraq, horrific crimes in Iraq. And they didn't like that. So they went after him. And, you know, I think to everybody's bizarre, astonishing belief, like Bitcoin worked.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and it was probably underreported at the time, but there's really nothing they could do about it. Now, at the time, it was seen as not that much of a threat because it wasn't worth, it was barely worth anything.
Yeah.
It was worth a couple dollars. It wasn't even worth more than $100 until 2013. So we're talking this little token that's worth a couple dollars. And yeah, people are sending it to this guy. But like, think about the idea of this. Like, if I want to donate to HRF, I've got to go to a website and fill out a form with all my information on
mm-hmm.
it. And I have to use a card that I needed a bank account to get. And there's just so many steps if you think about how can I send money to HRF.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a foreign national, it's very difficult. There's all these different things. There's all these layers of process and permission and You have to ask somebody if it's okay, basically, a million times before you can actually send the money. And then when you actually finally send the money, it's not really money, it's a credit. So it's a liability that could be retracted, right? It could be canceled.
Okay.
So the whole thing is like promises upon promises upon promises. Everything's permissioned. He pastes a string of numbers on his Twitter account, and anybody in the world can send him value, and nobody can stop it. And you don't need a bank account. So that was pretty extraordinary at the time. And it remains the use case for Bitcoin. Yeah. I mean, it's just whenever you need money that you don't want anybody to stop or take from you, you use Bitcoin.
So Alex, you saw him post this. You saw the utility of it. But when did it really sink in for you personally that you could use this as a tool that intersected directly?
Not for many years later. Yeah, so I'm very skeptical. We do these personality tests here. Mm-hmm. I'm 99% skeptical. So if there's 100 people in the room, I'm more skeptical than 90.
Somehow that tracks. Yeah.
So unfortunately, especially on this one, it really hurts.
It happens.
But 2 years later, 2013, I'm on a... Peter Thiel, before he went kind of crazy, was a supporter of a lot of press freedom stuff. Mm-hmm. This might be shocking to you, given what he did with Gawker. But before then, before he got pissed with Gawker, he loved press freedom. And he was a generous supporter of the Committee to Protect Journalists and the Human Rights Foundation. And he spoke actually at the same Oslo Freedom Forum as Assange, and which was very interesting. But needless to say, his foundation was involved with some event that was kind of like a Burning Man mixed with seasteading. It was in the Sacramento River Delta east of the Bay Area, and it was like people would come together and build a floating city that was ephemeral, and then it would go away, leaving no trace. Cool. So I think it still happens today. I went a few years in a row back then. It's called Ephemeral.
Never heard of it.
It was pioneered by these people who wanted to do these seasteads. They wanted to country or whatever. But it was a really fun experience, a lot of fun. And on my boat that week, because I lived there for a week, Bitcoin was just all the rage at that time. And there were no other cryptocurrencies really at the time. It was just Bitcoin. And people were really pushing it. And I was like, I was very skeptical. But this one guy, Idan Yago, was really pushing it, and we had a lot of conversations about it. And when I got home, he sent me this email, and it's the first, when I searched the word Bitcoin in my email inbox, which goes back, 17 years, it's the first time the word appears, not in a newsletter, but in an actual email from me. And he's like, hey, we are using Bitcoin to help Ukrainians who are protesting against the Yanukovych regime. Yanukovych had frozen the bank accounts of all these people who were mobilizing into what would later become Maidan Square.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, will you help us? And there's still this Reddit post that hasn't been deleted from September 2013, where it's like, hey, Kasparov and the Human Rights Fund, because Gary at the time was our chairman, still is, and he was very open to it. Gary loves Bitcoin, but he was very open to the idea back then, and I credit him for being open-minded on this. And we did this fundraiser. I can't remember how much we raised, but it was meaningful, and it worked. And to my astonishment, again, another example, right? Okay, it got money somewhere where the government didn't want it to go.
But not even that. That was one of the most successful democratic revolutions of the 21st century, and obviously we're still seeing the legacies of that. It's not just going to one person. This is proof positive that it can help expand democracy as we know it.
Yeah, that was a big one, and obviously the story is much more complicated than that, but Bitcoin at the time was very small. And, so there weren't that many Ukrainians using it. But it is part of the story where before the invasion of Ukraine by Putin a couple years ago, and probably still today, but certainly then, Ukraine had the most Bitcoin usage per capita of any country in the world.
Wow.
And, there's a lot of reasons for that. They've faced horrific hyperinflations in the 90s, where your wages went to zero. They faced a lot of economic difficulties. They had a lot of issues with being sanctioned or in Crimea or whatever, and their stuff not working. And the country has this very, I don't know if you know this, but they basically have this much more next gen than we do version of mobile banking, where you can just go with your phone and tap somebody's phone and pay them. It's like how it should be here.
Yeah.
They're very advanced on this stuff. So they were naturally a good fit for Bitcoin.
Yeah.
But the point is, that was interesting. 2014, the next year, one of our donors said, hey, I want to pay for my Oslo Freedom Forum tickets in Bitcoin. So we spun up a Coinbase wallet, which at the time was the only one in the App Store. And we, I don't know, let's see. So it was $3,000 for an Oslo Freedom Forum ticket. And this was after the Mt. Gox crash. So the price of Bitcoin at the time was probably about $300. So he probably paid roughly 10 Bitcoin for an Oslo Freedom Forum ticket. 10 Bitcoin is now $500,000.
Yeah, not bad.
So just to think about it. So That was interesting. And other donors also, you know, started to give us some Bitcoin.
Yeah,
bills with Bitcoin.
Alex, can I pause right there? I just realized what we're sitting right next to. Obviously, folks can't see this. It is a framed photo of a Bitcoin magazine.
Yeah, so that's
a cover
that's
of a Bitcoin magazine.
There's a Bitcoin magazine. It's a company in the United States that, that does Bitcoin stuff. There's a Ukrainian subsidiary called Bitcoin Magazine Ukraine, and they made a special edition, you know, print edition, and we sponsored it. So that's
so
why
cool.
Bitcoin Ukraina Svoboda, Bitcoin Ukraine Freedom. Look at that.
Very cool.
Yeah. No, that came much later. But the point is, at the time, the Ukraine thing is very tied in with why it matters. But we started getting donations. It started being beneficial for us. People kept pressuring me on it. I lived in the Bay Area at the time. People were always pressuring me about the stuff. And then finally, we did an Oslo Freedom Forum in San Francisco in 2016. And this guy named Bill Tai, who was a very early Bitcoin guy, Second Life guy, big into all this digital second parallel world stuff. He also was very wealthy and an investor in a lot of different things. He wrote the first angel check for Zoom, for example. that did pretty well. There's a photo of him ringing the bell when they went public. But anyway, Bill Tai was like, "Listen, man, there's something here. So come visit me and we'll talk about it." So maybe a couple months later, winter 2016, I went down to his office and we talked about it. And he convinced me that it was worth doing. And he's like, "Look, I'm on the board of this Bitcoin mining company called Bitfury, which happens to be based in Georgia, the country, where they have a lot of basically excess hydro mining where the energy is wasted." So these guys, these Georgian entrepreneurs were like, "Well, instead of wasting it, we'll just turn it into Bitcoin." And they've done very well. And Bill was on the board of Bitfury, and Bitfury sponsored the first Oslo Freedom Forum event, where it was like Bitcoin human rights session. And that was, so that was May 2017, which was a very exciting time for Bitcoin. That year was crazy. You know, Bitcoin had reached $1,200 at the end of 2013, and then crashed horribly after, like, the largest exchange went bankrupt, was defrauding people. And that, like, basically killed Bitcoin for a while. It dropped all the way to almost $300. And then it started a slow build. You know, Bitcoin goes in these cycles with prices. And it had just passed $2,000 while we were at the Oslo Freedom Forum, finally. So it had kind of come all the way back up. And later that year, it would get up to almost $20,000. It was a crazy bubble. But point is, it was an exciting time for Bitcoin. There was also a big conflict inside Bitcoin at the time. It's called the Block Size War. There's a great book on it called The Block Size War. And it was a battle for the soul of Bitcoin between basically Chinese miners and Silicon Valley corporations and Wall Street versus freedom activists. And it was a very David and Goliath thing. 80% of the hash rate, meaning 80% of all the mining equipment, most of the addresses that existed, a lot of the Bitcoin that existed, to all the sort of big merchants and exchanges, they all wanted to change Bitcoin to make it so that they could earn more money on it through fees, but that would make it less decentralized. So they wanted to centralize Bitcoin. They wanted to sacrifice the decentralization part to make for profit. And then there were like a bunch of pseudonymous activists who said, "No, we're actually gonna keep it decentralized." And I was watching this, and the crazy part was they won. And I was like, wow, okay. So like, this is interesting. So it can repel massive attacks from like state level actors. Like, for example, it was very clear probably that the Chinese government was involved in the mining at the time. And the idea that the Chinese government tried to sort of influence Bitcoin and failed was super interesting to me. So I was like, all right, I'm going to double down and look into this more. And then it just grew from there. And every year we added a little bit more. And I tried to take it very slow because HRF is not, you know, it's a civil liberties group. So I wanted to be delicate about it. But also, I was learning, and there's a big learning curve with Bitcoin, because when you're first introduced, there's like all these tokens, these crypto tokens. And when you're first introduced, especially at that time, people were like, "Oh, there's like a privacy token. And then there's like a token for censorship resistant storage. And I was always being pitched like these ideas for, oh, cool, you're into human rights. Well, you should use this token. And it took me a while to basically later realize these were all scams and they were all pyramid schemes or whatever. But at the time, it was very alluring. And I didn't know that. So it took me a year or two to figure that out.
Find your footing.
Yeah, and to be like, wait a second, all this other stuff is nonsense. Yeah. And we should be focusing on Bitcoin because it's one open, neutral currency for everybody. Same rules for everybody.
Alex, bring us back to HRF now. What is the Bitcoin Development Fund? When did that come in?
Yeah.
And what's been the impact of that, even through where we're in 2024?
Well, the point is we were slowly doing a little bit more at HRF with Bitcoin. And I realized that there's not that much funding for open source software generally. It's kind of hard, whether it's Tor or any kind of open source project. Funding developers is difficult. And it's no different with Bitcoin. And at the time, there weren't that many entities funding Bitcoin developers. You know, if you're an open source Bitcoin developer, you're already taking what's known as a sole dividend, where you're going to make 1/5 of what you would working at Google, but you're working on something you love. People, they call this the sole dividend. So it's already tricky because you don't make that much money, and there's not that much money for it. So I thought it'd be cool if HRF entered the space as an organization that could provide independent funding for open source developers working to make Bitcoin a better tool for human rights activism. So cool. And at the time, the only other really nonprofit that was doing it was MIT's DCI. So up in Cambridge, they have something called the Digital Currency Initiative. And they gave a couple grants out a year, and I thought that was neat, but no one else was really doing it. So I was like, well, let's be the first like human rights group to start funding Bitcoin stuff. So a donor gave a gift of like $100,000 that year to allow us to start doing some grants. And then I just kept raising money for it. And now we give away $2 million a year.
It's amazing.
$500,000 a quarter to about 50 projects, mainly in authoritarian countries, where people are building tools and organizing and educating about how to use Bitcoin as opposed to the local fiat currency.
But it's still not a popular thing among other human rights groups, right? Or are they finally catching on as slowly
really
as well?
Around. I think it's slow. I think that you haven't seen that much yet among the other major ones.
Yeah.
But it's behind the scenes it's happening. And especially the like human rights groups based in authoritarian countries are like very on it.
Right.
Like if there's like an Egyptian think tank, they're knowledgeable.
It's necessity though.
Like for example, the Navalny Anti-Corruption Foundation that Navalny started. They do their entire payroll in Bitcoin, all of it.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's an example, right? And again, as we were doing a little bit more through, you know, this 2017 to today, like each year we were doing more, we were learning more because activist groups were doing more. So we were like constantly in this back and forth of learning and then passing that wisdom down. So today, like we have this program called the Financial Freedom Program. And
that's right.
One leg is the Bitcoin Development Fund. And if you're listening and you have a cool project, totally apply. And then the other two legs are education, public education, and trainings. So the public education piece, we do a lot of like short videos. We do podcasts like this. We do talks. We have some marketing spend that we'll do at other conferences. You know, we'll do stuff at South by Southwest. We'll do stuff at, I've done interviews with Bloomberg or all over the place. And then trainings, we're going to start actually, I'm really excited in March, we're going to start a public webinar for anyone, and we're going to do it quarterly, and it'll be a week long, 1 hour per day, geared at the activists in our network, and they can come online with the best trainer in the world, and they can learn how to use this thing.
Can so anyone nice. Access that webinar that's going
to
be?
Yeah, coming? Well, it's like we get to decide because it's an HRF project, but basically we're working on it now. The idea is to ship the comm about it in late March, and it'll basically be like free and open webinar for learning how to use Bitcoin as a nonprofit organization. And we'll do this on a quarterly basis. And that'll be our own in-house one.
Yep.
But some organizations that we're friendly with are doing something similar. Atlas is doing something similar, which I'm excited about. They have something similar. And we're working with Canvas, led by Sergey Popovich, our own Janice Vakadaza, who does the Freedom Fellows, as well as the World Liberty Congress. So each of those units has its own Bitcoin training that I've helped bring into existence.
That's fantastic.
And it just keeps going. And now there's Felix Maradiaga and Bert Davale are doing one for Nicaraguans, which is very important. I mean Nicaragua. The Ortega regime just debanked the Catholic Church in Nicaragua.
Yeah, that's right.
So the Catholic Church doesn't have a bank account anymore. So Bitcoin usage is going to explode there. So the point is, like, we're doing the trainings. We're doing the education, and then we're funding.
Yeah.
So this is the program. And
building, yeah, momentum and continuing.
It's great because, like, we get a lot of attention and support. We've been able to raise a lot of money for the Human Rights Foundation through this. Lots of money. And lots of Bitcoin, rather. And we've been able to pioneer Bitcoin management from a nonprofit, meaning, like receiving Bitcoin gifts, giving grants in Bitcoin. Like, we've pioneered all this.
Yeah.
And we have that knowledge that we can transfer to other nonprofits, regardless of their sector. And we also get invited to speak in front of some really interesting audiences. Like, so right now I'm staring at Hudson Yards.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I'm going over there later today to speak at BlackRock, the largest asset manager in the world, which is insane. If you had told me 10 years ago I'd be speaking at BlackRock, I'd be like,
let alone Bitcoin.
What's the subject? I mean, like, what is the...
So they're doing a digital asset summit because BlackRock just launched an ETF based on spot Bitcoin. So basically anyone in their retirement account now can have some exposure to the Bitcoin price by selecting the BlackRock ETF. There's a bunch of other ETFs. And in fact, one of them called Bitwise, which I think the ticker is BITB. So Bitwise is giving 10% of its profits for the next 10 years to HRF and two other organizations.
That's right.
So that'll be a nice six-figure. I mean, they already have $1 billion under management. It's a very successful product, even though it's a small team. I think they're the fourth most popular Bitcoin ETF. And I think it'll become a trend among all these ETFs. They're going to donate back to open source development. So the point is, I'll be talking to BlackRock's top 100 clients about Bitcoin and human rights later today.
Alex,
so cool.
We have only maybe another minute or two left. Just as a final question for you,
where I'm can so folks interested.
Learn more about what HRF is doing, the utility of Bitcoin? I know we mentioned the webinar. Is it as simple as coming to the HRF website and seeing what we have available there? Are there any other recommended resources for listeners to learn more?
Yeah, so we're working on a new reboot for the Financial Freedom homepage, which will have everything. For now, my main go-to is this thing called getbitcoin.org that we created, which is like, I always was like, well, like, you know, if you meet somebody in a taxi and you want to like share info with them about why this matters, we didn't have a tool for that. So now we do. So it's a very simple page that explains the connection between human freedom and Bitcoin, and it helps you get your first Bitcoin. So it's double entendre, right? Get Bitcoin. It has a lot of educational resources. So I'd probably steer you to that. But I think this is... this is going to be increasingly important, and I'm happy we're pioneering this, because the logical end game of the current banking and financial system is something called the central bank digital currency. And we've also launched a project to track those called the CBDC Tracker.
Yes.
And look at that. Anytime HRF has launched that, which tracks the largely authoritarian-led development of these central bank digital currencies, which are the goal of these things is to replace cash, which, although not perfect, gives people privacy and freedom to a large extent. Cash is a fabulous human rights tool. So they don't like cash, right? So if you tried to invent cash today, you'd be put in jail. Like that. That's a serious quote. Like, that would happen. But they can't like undo it, so they're slowly shifting out cash. And I think by the end of the decade, cash will basically be not used.
There was something on social media recently where this look in the UK was trying to just pay for some strawberries with coins, and they wouldn't allow it.
Well, in China, even if you go to like a rural area, someone with a street cart, they have a WeChat QR code.
Yeah.
They don't accept cash. So they've totally purged cash from the communist society in China. And that's the goal everywhere. So the point being, money will be a system of control where you can only buy so much meat or gas or whatever, and you can't buy these particular books or have this medical procedure, or you can't donate to this group. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's the end game. I mean, it's terrifying. And the fact that Bitcoin exists is very exciting because it means we don't have to comply. We have a plan B. We have an exit, and anyone in the world can use it. And it's very powerful. And it's exciting to be able to help the human rights community harness this thing, make it its own, and push it forward.
And to be ahead of the curve and to be able to educate other organizations and individuals and communities that are just now realizing, just now discovering the utility of this as well.
And also really quickly say that Alex has some books if you want to educate yourself further on this. One is Check Your Financial Privilege.
I do, yeah.
That, I think if I can, I'll probably do a terrible job of distilling it, but talks about how the existing system, financial system is so bad for financial freedom.
Alex, how many books have you written? We had a
three
back and forth with one of our colleagues.
I collaborated on this book sprint 5 years ago, which was really fun. And me and seven other people from a bunch of countries around the world wrote this thing called the Little Bitcoin Book, which is in 20 languages.
That's so cool.
If you go to littlebitcoinbook.org, you can download a free copy in like Burmese, Uyghur, all kinds of languages. And it's like a very simplistic primer. It's 100 pages. It's a beach read. But it's you know, for someone who doesn't know anything, and it might be a little out of...
It's probably be for
little
me.
Dated.
I know. It's
it
for me.
Depends on the beaches.
It's probably a little dated on some of the technical stuff now. It's 5 years old. But I think it's a great general overview. But Check Your Financial Privilege is my book that details the basically two things, the history of the current financial system and the rise of Bitcoin, like simultaneously, in places like Cuba, Palestine, West Africa, Afghanistan, and why in difficult political environments people are adopting it. And then I also have a book called Hidden Repression, which analyzes the IMF and World Bank's ties to dictators and asks big questions around why do they support dictators, and I try to unravel that kind of apple, which is not a fun one to unravel.
Can only imagine.
And then I'm excited to, I guess, announce that I'm working on a compendium of works that'll come out hopefully later this year.
Can you stop being
so talented?
Which will
be like a special edition.
When do you sleep?
Yeah, when do you sleep?
Well, I already wrote this stuff, but basically it'll be like a really sweet, like, very expensive leather bound.
Oh, that's so cool.
Which will be three parts. The first one will be Check Your Financial Privilege, a kind of revised edition. Second chapter will be my second book. And the third chapter will be all my other essays that never made it into a book form.
Very cool.
Including one I just released last month called Stranded. And this whole thing will be basically a collector's edition.
Yeah.
You know, people will be able to buy copies, but it's mainly for me to give to certain people who've helped me along the way. And I'm trying to get it so that it's heat-sensitive ink.
Ah.
And the idea is that one of my major theories that I've promoted is this idea that Bitcoin is a Trojan horse for freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a clip online when I did the Lex Fridman podcast. Mm-hmm. It went totally viral. It has like 1 million views. And it's me explaining how the actual literal Trojan horse myth from Greek mythology relates to Bitcoin. And suffice it to say that, you know, BlackRock and Wall Street like Bitcoin not because they're interested in human rights. They aren't.
Yeah.
They're interested because they're greedy and money. Self-interested and they want to make money. But that's the Trojan horse. What's inside is freedom.
Mm-hmm.
So people say Bitcoin's about number go up, which it is. It is number go up because it's scarce and fiat money's infinite. And yes, Bitcoin's going to get more valuable into the future. It's a very good long-term investment for sure. But what people miss is that as it rises and grows, so does freedom. So like that's the idea. So that's what will be the title. It'll be A Trojan Horse for Freedom, collected works by Alex or whatever.
Well,
hopefully
we can chill that later this year.
In this new office, we'll get a couple more leather-bound books as well.
Yeah,
to fill out the new.
We need
new
some more. Here. Add some more prestige to the office.
Absolutely, a little bit of class.
Yeah,
can go a long way. Alex, this has been a great conversation.
Yeah, thanks
I
for
feel like
me.
I could do this all day.
Absolutely,
I
think the folks at BlackRock are going to get their money's worth.
It's tight.
Or their Bitcoin value is worth.
We're just going to have we're just going to have you on again.
But this was wonderful. You already told folks where they can find more about this.
And we'll
link it in the show notes. And again, keep an eye open for that the leather-bound volume coming very soon as well.
Let's do it. Thanks so much, Alex.
Yep.
Thanks, Alex.
The Human Rights Foundation is a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization that promotes and protects human rights globally, with a focus on closed societies. We promote freedom where it's most at risk, in countries ruled by authoritarian regimes.